The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made it to start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning Pacific Time Space Show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. And it's good to be back live from, again, our long break as we moved to Nevada and set up new studios. So we're really happy to be broadcasting live with you. And I hope you're enjoying a sort of return of the Space Show after about 10 days or maybe 2 weeks of absence. We have a couple of announcements for you for today. Today is a 60-minute format program, so do pay attention to the clock and make sure that if you want to get a question in for our listeners, for our guests, then do it while we're still on the air. The same for email. Email, by the way, is drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can give us a toll-free phone call at 866-687-7223. A couple of other quick announcements. For Sunday, we have BioHarvest, and their CEO is in Israel, Elon. And they, as I've been announcing this, sent me a teaser PR about growing cannabis in space and doing things with it on the space station. So I tended to dismiss that as kind of a joke. But I did send it to my advisory board, and they said, no, not a joke. We know the company. They're doing a lot of stuff with plant growth in space. Get him on the phone. So Elon, and I forget his last name for the moment, is the CEO of BioHarvest. They're an Israeli company, and he will be with us on Sunday. And on Tuesday, Dr. Zhu, Z-H-U, I read an article about how he's developing motion capture in guiding the next generation of extraterrestrial robots. So I couldn't pass that one up, could I? So Dr. Zhu, again, C-H-U, is our guest for Tuesday. Hotel Mars is up in the air. We're waiting to hear from John Batchelor on that. And on Friday, Brendan and Matt from the Harvard Economic Department are back. Well, Matt is back at least. And they are actually starting a commercial space program in their economics department. And they want to talk about that on the Space Show. But when Matt was on last time, which was not quite a year ago, my favorite question to ask economists is, with our rising debt and the promise of interest rates to rise, and inflation starting, it was just starting back around the time of Matt's first appearance, are you at all concerned for the economy and for the space community? And in typical fashion, the answer was, no, space is so tiny, it's not going to be affected by any of this, nothing's really going to happen. Well, I think we're seeing a different scenario, and I will certainly be asking Matt about that, in addition to finding out why Harvard wants to start a commercial space program in their economics school, which to me is pretty amazing and beneficial and impressive. So that's what's coming up on the Space Show. You can reach us today. Again, our toll-free number, 866-687-7223, and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't forget you can post a blog comment if you want. So you go to thespaceshow.com, go to upcoming show menus. The first program listed is our program today with Jordan Noon of Embedded Ventures. Click on that. That is our archive page. And if you scroll down, you will see a place to submit comments or questions. As soon as you do, I get a copy of them, and I can integrate your comment or question into our discussion. Jordan Noon has had a lifelong interest in aerospace. He began designing and building spaceflight hardware at USC. He led the USC Rocket Propulsion Lab and became the first student and youngest individual in the world to receive an FAA clearances to fly a rocket into space. After graduating, Noon worked at SpaceX and later co-founded and was the CTO of 3D printing rocket startup Relativity Space, most recently valued at $4.2 billion. He is a co-founder at Embedded Ventures, and I've given you information, website links, and other stuff in the promos for this show. So, everybody, meet Jordan Noon. And, Jordan, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Thank you, David. I'm doing well. How are you?
Very, very good. Did you take classes with Mike Grundman or James Wirtz?
I never actually took classes with either, but I was quite close to Mike. He was one of the professors that helped oversee the astronautical engineering department while I was at USC.
Mike is a very, very close friend and a great friend of the Space Show. And Jim, too. Jim and I, in earlier years, did lots and lots of things together, and he was a very frequent guest on the program. And he recently submitted and came back on the program for a gigantic plan on how to develop and go to the moon. And plus a lot of students from USC come on the Space Show. I have good connections there, also with Madhu, who you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever do anything in his design class?
I never actually took his class, but I presented in it a number of times as an alumni. I went to USC as an aerospace engineering student. I didn't actually know about the astronautical engineering department when I applied. So I ended up in aero, loved it, took a lot of classes, and then a lot of classes in both departments, and then ran USC's Rocket Propulsion Lab, which was technically under the astronautical engineering department and the leadership of Dr. Dan Irwin, who was the department chair for the majority of the department's history.
So I always wanted to talk about Relativity Space, but you're no longer with them, but something may come up about that. As I understand it, Embedded Ventures is kind of like a specialty fund to finance already existing aerospace startups with a track record. Am I getting that correct?
At a high level, yeah, and I can dive into Relativity, Embedded, all that we're up to, because I think my story, you know, even starting at USC, going to SpaceX, starting Relativity, then Jenna, who's my co-founder at Embedded, finding me and us building Embedded together, and then all the companies we're up to today, it all kind of blends together, you know, in an interesting way of my career and in journey. But yes, for Embedded, our thesis is space technology beyond launch with a focus on dual-use tech. It's hard to avoid dual-use in the space sector, but it's something that differentiates us quite a bit from the rest of the venture community, having that government focus by default. And when we say space technology beyond launch, it's really looking at the success of venture-backed commercial rocket launch. And seeing that really hitting an inflection point with SpaceX starting 20 years ago. But the question we have is, as rocket launch becomes almost daily and, in a sense, boring, you know, rocket launch and landing, you know, it's an exciting thing to see, but I am looking forward to the day, and it's what we invest in as a fund, is what happens when rocket launch is boring. And it's things happening in space that are the focus. How do you drive investment and growth into those areas?
The reason I cautioned you about a global audience with listeners in places that are not so friendly with the U.S. is because you do dual use. So when I do national security or government programs, I always caution about that because I don't know who's listening. And because it's on the Internet, I want you to know that you don't know who's listening. So that's why I made that comment. You know, rocket launch is starting to get a little boring already. So I get countless media SpaceX PR messages about their next Starlink launch. And I used to go and look at all of them, and I don't anymore. You know, they become kind of routine. Maybe I'm missing something, but, you know, unless there's something really unusual about it, I don't put the time in to go watch something that I believe is just normal routine, and that includes a SpaceX Starlink launch and other launches for that matter, too. So it's already happening. And the missions are pretty routine, right? They're uneventful. Thank God they're uneventful. So how do you keep them from getting boring?
Well, the main area we look at as a fund, you know, is, again, you know, space technology beyond launch is our summary, but, you know, what's in there? And a lot of it was relying on our experience, you know, me coming from Relativity. And you know, we started Relativity in 2015. It was just me and Tim, you know, in a WeWork in Seattle, you know, end of 2015.
Right.
Trying to enter the launch market at a time where there were companies thriving. You know, SpaceX was doing extremely well, you know, major inflection point for Falcon 9 in 2015. It was only a couple weeks after starting Relativity that the first Falcon 9 landed. You know, it was the return to launch site in December of 2015. And it was something where SpaceX was very active. Rocket Lab had really hit, you know, its market entrance. You know, Virgin and, you know, the Virgin companies were thriving. Virgin Orbit had, you know, spun out, I think, either immediately before or after that. And we were these two young kids. You know, I was 22, Tim was 25. And, you know, there was this question we had to answer to the investment community that was looking at us as far as why us. You know, there's very few investors that are willing to lean into the space investment community anyway. You know, it was looking saturated, and we had this crazy idea of 3D printing rockets and developing the world's largest metal 3D printer. And that was something that we really had to tell that story well in order to win investors as far as why did, you know, entering the market with that approach when the market was saturated and dominated by these established players that were doing well. Why did it make sense to do that? And we saw how difficult it was to get investors, despite, you know, what, you know, I think has proven out over time is a very good idea, very good execution, and very strong differentiation that warrants that market entry, you know, that late market entry. There, very few investors even wanted to hear it. You know, that's something that me and Jenna resonated on so much as we got to know each other, is you hear, you know, about all these venture capitalists and they, you know, gloat on Twitter about how they're willing to learn anything. They're willing to, you know, learn about new sectors and create these amazing companies from nothing. But then when you actually talk to them with a new idea, they're like, oh, we've never heard of something, you know, in that sector before. We can't invest in that. You know, or there's not a comparable company to compare to. You know, how do we make an investment decision? And that, for me, coming as an engineer who looked at these people as, you know, some of the world's strongest innovators at where they invest, it was all pattern matching. It was all looking for, you know, de-risking, not by understanding the company, but by looking for, you know, an example in the market that had already been successful. And that's why you see so little investment leaning into that space sector. So it was my Relativity chapter, and, you know, I wanted to go, you know, from scratch again. That was really my path towards my next chapter in 2020, you know, I was CTO of Relativity, you know, co-founder, but CTO for the first 5 years. The company was getting to a size where I felt it was inevitable. I felt that I didn't have to be there day to day anymore. And what ended up happening, and we can dive into the embedded backstory, you know, a little bit more here, is that I ended up getting recruited into venture capital by Jenna. Jenna's my co-founder at the fund, amazing background herself. You know, she's one of the most non-traditional people in the venture community that I know. Then going from Auburn to Cal State Northridge with a fashion design major, and then getting into tech recruiting, getting to know anyone and everyone in tech, getting to know how to evaluate people super early stage as far as are they going to be good hires. And that's an amazing skill set for figuring out early stage investment opportunities and then mentoring and growing them as recruiters, growing those founders, that is. But it's something that her and I resonated quite a bit on. Why are there so few venture investors that are willing to learn new areas? When they advertise, they do it. They don't actually do it. And that's something that led to that thesis, her background, my background, and the beyond launch category, was that it's hard enough to get investors to lean into launch. But launch is past its inflection point. You know, if you're doing early stage investing in launch in, you know, 2018, 2019, you know, and onwards, you're really too late. And so many investors are trying to chase early stage investment opportunities when they're way too late to a market. There's very little differentiation left to capture by the early stage community. And that's really where we landed, which was us having the opportunity to be the first check in sectors that no other investor is willing to lean into, no other investor is willing to learn about, because of our backgrounds or willingness, and be the first investor in those sectors beyond launch, some of which don't either exist today or don't get venture capital activity today. And that's our kind of main mode and differentiator as a fund.
So the companies that you work with, so we've been doing space shows with groups that put together exchange traded funds, and companies that have decided to go public with SPACs. So we've done a fair share of giving these companies and these programs airtime. But that's really different from what you're doing, correct?
That's correct. When we're, you know, saying early stage, that's generally, you know, first checking a company, you know, finding founders that have, you know, some level of relevant background, the motivation to start a company, and then we work with them, you know, not only to build our investment thesis, but so many of these companies are so early that we're looking for deals, signal, you know, direction of these that is really non-obvious. You know, you're trying to find the right founder with the right potential, the right ability to build a company, a team, and then a thesis for their strategy for the company that is often one that is not anchored in current market dynamics. You know, if you're looking, one example, you know, of a company we look at today that's in our portfolio is Slingshot Aerospace. They do space traffic control, automated maneuvering, then of satellites, you know, automatic collision avoidance and risk mitigation, looking at the entire space ecosystem, while having the best data aggregation as far as figuring out, you know, in what is a fairly uncertain data set, you know, exact positioning in order to understand space maneuvering as a non-trivial data problem and data reliability problem. And where they're providing that infrastructure to a variety of satellite operators and significant government players. But do we know exactly how that market's going to play out in 5 years? You know, no. You know, and that's something that makes it difficult to make that thesis. But we see how the company's operating, the founders are navigating it, and enough insight into how the market's going to move, you know, both on a government and commercial side, that we can make that bet. And we've been really happy there. You know, another company is Inversion Space. So they do low-cost reentry capsules. And we invested in them. We were the first check in them back in 2020. And the beginning of 2021, the company was just two founders. One of them was a former relativity intern. And that's how I got to know them. But they reached out saying that they wanted to solve reentry costs. You know, launch costs are coming down. You know, everyone's seeing that. But who's reentering? You know, who's having something that you can bring a payload back on? That's being, you know, whether that's something from a space station, in-space manufacturing, resource extraction, spare parts, you know, kind of anything that's up in space where you want to maintenance it back on the ground, you want to refly it, you need to take trash from a space station, you know, again, whatever you need where there's an in-space logistics problem that involves reentry. How many vehicles reenter and land, you know, not just reenter and burn up? You know, you're talking about SpaceX with Dragon, you know, Boeing has their vehicle that's up in the air as of yesterday. And then a couple governments. You know, you're not going to have that same dramatic cost in reentry that you do in launch. So they're trying to solve that through low-cost reentry capsules that are reusable. You know, you fly 30 of them on a Falcon 9, and they spread apart. They each land in unique locations, and then you refurbish them after they come back. But I bring that up because that market's not active today. You know, if you were a company at scale today, you wouldn't have a commercial or government market that would support that. And it's our job and the job of the company to help, you know, not only make the investment bet on timing of how that market's going to develop, where, you know, we're expecting an active ecosystem of players bringing things back from space, you know, that they need landed and protected, in, but also that the company can help build that up on a customer base, on a government customer base. And it's those bets where those companies are very small, nascent markets, and we're trying to figure out which of those nascent markets are moving in the right direction, especially with a, you know, a company active in those sectors or growing active in those sectors. Which one of those are going to pay, you know, dividends on investment returns in 5 years, in 10 years? But it's a big bet on when the timing for those makes sense.
You have your first email question, which is Todd in San Diego. And he says, who invests in your opportunity fund? Is it available to anyone or is it private?
We have a great question, Todd, and thank you for asking. We recently, it was just earlier this week, we publicly announced what we call the Embedded Ventures Opportunity Fund. We have a variety of private funds internal to Embedded, which is where we do all of our investment opportunities or our investment, you know, deals out of.
Mm-hmm.
And traditional fund structures can be very limiting in who can access them. You know, high minimum investment thresholds.
Right.
You know, very large commitments. And that's something that really frustrated us is people that don't come from investment banking. You know, we don't, you know, we're not bankers. We're not finance people. You know, we're engineers and operators. And that's something that we wanted to open up access to those investment opportunities to the greater community, especially people, founders, engineers, people that, you know, people like listeners to this show, people that were, you know, like me 5, 7 years ago, where I was super passionate and I wanted to support that community and get involved with some companies that, you know, are super passionate in seeing them build up and grow. So we launched the Opportunity Fund. It's a fund on AngelList. So if you go to our Embedded Ventures website, there's an Invest With Us button in the top left corner that takes you to the page for the Opportunity Fund. But that is a fund set up with very specific kind of regulatory compliance work in order to let us publicly fundraise for that that Opportunity Fund. And so anyone can invest. You have to go to the website, you know, sign up for an AngelList account, you know, and you can subscribe quarter by quarter. And it's a $10,000 minimum quarterly subscription, and that's, you know, not, that's not for everyone, but it's a lot more people than the institutional threshold. It's thousands of times, it's not millions of times more people than normal funds are allowed to bring in because that threshold is so low. You know, we can't set it lower. You know, it's just one of the complications on a regulatory side, but $10,000 per quarter is something accessible by, you know, there's a lot of people who are day-to-day engineers, operators within the aerospace community. Who is who we wanted to cater to. So for anyone interested, hit the button on our website. You know, there's a page on there, a button on there. You can message us as the founders, the general partners, if you have any questions. And we have a lot of FAQ stuff on there as well to make the barrier to entry, anything on a question side of how the fund operates or getting in touch with us. There's a link that helps you sort through that on an FAQ side. But again, great question because that's something we wanted out there because these opportunities are, you know, things that so many of us are passionate about and don't have access to. Like me as even an early stage founder 5 years ago, I could never support the community of other founders in the ecosystem. And it's something that is just such a mutual value add and an opportunity we didn't want to let by.
So listeners, I'll link to it when I archive the show, but you want to go to this button and upper left that says invest with us, and then you can get the information that he is actually talking about. Let me give out the phone numbers, and they are available if you would like to call 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Listeners, don't forget the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit. And we exist and bring you great programming like the one you're hearing today because many of you do financially contribute to the program. And as a nonprofit, if you're paying federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. We are still a California nonprofit, so check with your state to see if you get a state deduction. Many states do offer that for you. I don't know the rules in all 50 states. And there is a huge PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. But if you are old school like me and you want to send a check, it's made payable to One Giant Leap Foundation. And make sure you pick up our new address on the website in Las Vegas, do not send it to the old P.O. box in Tiburon, California, because then everybody's dependent on whether the post office is actually going to forward the mail or not. And I can tell you so far after 2 weeks, they have not been forwarding the mail. So, I guess that's to be expected. So again, if you have any questions about that or the new address or something, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't forget our sponsors and our billboard advertising program with the banner ads and the PR messages. And our sponsors, since this is a shorter format show, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society make the space show possible. And if you'd like to be a sponsor, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We have great ways for you to do that. And the same if you want to use the banner ad and the messages to promote an idea, a thought, a potential change in something, space settlement, and you want to get it out to a bigger audience, contact me at that email address as well, and we can help you do that. So going back to embedded ventures, is the economy jeopardizing anything you're doing with these kinds of, I'm going to say new, but new may not be accurate, tech companies? And to me, I think a lot of the private space industry is still fragile, even though some of it, like launches, seeming to get matured.
That's a great question, and it's a bit of a complex answer there as far as how we view it. And it's something that when Jen and I started Embedded, it was end of 2020, and it was as the market was really going crazy on capital outflows, especially, you know, in the venture ecosystem, and especially by a lot of the larger kind of established players. You know, we saw a bunch of craziness in all the markets over the last, you know, 24 months, and a lot inverting over the last couple here. But it's something that the way we viewed it as far as a fund of founders and operators and, you know, advisors that are active in the ecosystem that help us diligence these companies. And we didn't want to do the same kind of rush that so much of the other community was doing to deploy capital haphazardly. Then we felt there was a lot of reckless investing happening. We saw that especially with the SPAC market. You know, the space SPAC market is one that has gotten absolutely demolished over the last year.
Right.
And it's highlighted not only the challenges in building a good company underneath, but also the recklessness of the venture capital community. And as much as, you know, we're called venture capitalists here at Embedded, I think, you know, we try to differentiate ourselves from the majority of the community sometimes. And when we started Relativity, even to rewind further, you know, the market was not crazy. You know, it was a saturated launch community. And as far as companies active in the sector, fundraising was hard. It was a very difficult company to fundraise for because it was such a complex story. We were such young founders. We didn't have an established track record, you know, really whatsoever. And, but we learned really well to fundraise and to be diligent at building a company that was lean, that knew what it was doing, that had a growth plan. And it's funny that as we started Embedded, I almost felt, out of date in fundraising, early stage fundraising. Obviously, I was on the other side of the table, but all of a sudden these investors and founders had, apologies if you hear any barking in the background.
We're a dog friendly show, so that's fine.
Dog friendly show.
Dog friendly show, yeah.
But no, the, what ended up happening within, the markets where you saw capital just flowing into every company out there. You know, you didn't need a business plan. You didn't need a growth strategy. You didn't even need a path to revenue. You know, you see some companies that got massive financing over the last, you know, 24 months.
Right.
And that's something that, you talk to them and you're like, oh, what's your path to revenue? And they would say, oh, we don't have one. And you'd be like, oh, how do you plan to monetize, your product? And they'd say, oh, we just have the product, we're working on it, we'll come up with a plan to monetize it later. And it was absurd. And you saw these companies raising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollar valuations. And that's something that was very alarming for us to see, but you saw so many people chasing these companies, chasing these opportunities, throwing money at them, and it's going to be really unfortunate. And I think what's happening economically as far as recession on capital getting frozen, you know, people very hesitant to spend, especially in the venture community. We're not even at the worst of it yet, because I think the majority of the repercussions of the last 24 months have yet to be seen. You know, markdowns on investments, portfolios completely collapsing as far as the value of them. You see that highlighted in the pre-IPO or near public funds, you know, today, where, you know, they're marking down, you know, high double digit percents of their gains over the last couple decades. Right, decades of gains erased in months. And that definitely is just the beginning of that becoming public on how bad those losses are and how reckless the investment community was in creating that. How that affects us and our portfolio, you know, we were very diligent, as I was saying. You know, we built a very strong investment thesis and process and deployed in only a handful of companies. And some of those companies were the ones being ignored by the rest of the venture ecosystem. You know, in some founders out there, you know, you see the susceptibility and the danger of the venture kind of gambling happen. Because we would talk to some founders and we would ask them, you know, questions. We'd have diligence questions on them, standard investment process. And they were telling us that their other investors were telling them that if there were new incoming investors that had diligence questions, to pass on them, to pass on the investors, because it was too much work to do to answer diligence questions and only to accept checks from investors that had no questions. And that was something that we found absolutely absurd. But the investment community trained them to take easy, quick money, and what ends up resulting is bad companies with lots of money, with high valuations, no plans on growth, no plans on revenue, and these founders that have no idea how to fundraise during a downturn, and also like cap tables, the actual investor base for these companies being people with no skills at even evaluating or understanding what their companies do. And you're going to see a massive collapse there, and it's really unfortunate. So I think our portfolio is safe. Our portfolio we were very diligent with, and aerospace tends to be more robust on capital, you know, inflows and outflows in most markets. And but as these companies grow, you know, they will have to learn those skills of fundraising and growing a company during an economic downturn. And I think for all the companies that we've invested in, they're robust on their market and that their market approach. And but it is something where they will be tested on the skills of fundraising during difficult times, and that's where we plan to be helpful. You know, we can be helpful in lots of ways as an investor. I don't see any, you know, major red flags in the portfolio. I'd say some may have slightly lower growth than expected, but nothing that is existential risk or existential, you know, negativity on the potential returns that we were expecting. The part of the investment community that was reckless, they're going to really eat it, and it's unfortunate, and there's going to be founders and companies that all suffer because of 24 months of reckless venture investing.
So my contribution to your story is that I have noticed for the past 2 years, public relation firms have sprung into existence, or at least they call themselves PR firms, and it seems to me they go after anything with the word space in it, to tell the story of a company that is not a company. So I get about 5 or 6 of these a week. We represent ABC Space Company, who just got a founder's round, a seed round, round two of $2.5 million. We need to come on the space show and tell your listeners about it. So I will Google the company, and essentially it's non-existent. They have no revenue from operations. They have no operations. In fact, they have a lofty group of team members, some that are credentialed. Every once in a while, I've heard of one or two of them, but not very often. And a lot of promises and a lot of plans. And this PR person's job is to get them attention. So obviously, they go to the space show. They don't know the first thing about it. They don't know what kind of show it is or anything. But they can then show the company, see, we made we reached out to 25 space companies, and this is the result and all that. So sometimes I'll follow them up. I hardly do it anymore because now I know the answer. And I would say, I can't see that you're actually doing anything other than raising money. So tell me what you're doing. Why do you deserve to be on the space show? It's not an infomercial firm. It's something about what you're accomplishing. And it doesn't look to me like you've even commenced with your hardware or your operations yet. Well, usually I never hear back from them after that. So there's your ignore people asking due diligence questions. Well, this, of course, is coming from the media. Some of them will write back and say, you're right, we're a startup. We don't have any operating revenues yet. We'll get back to you as soon as we start operations, predicted for September 15th of whatever. And I'm still getting 5 to 7 of these PR announcements a week. I send them around to friends sometimes because there's nothing in them. And it's just one company after another with young people, sometimes not so young, saying they're going to do this, this, and this in one sector of commercial space. And they have gotten capital. I'm assuming that's going to end, because capital is not flowing like it used to. And half these companies, Jordan, aren't even doing what they say their business plan is all about. I've never seen anything like it, and I've noticed it over the last 2 years. But, boy, for 2022, it has been stronger with the PR invites than I've ever seen it in all the years of doing the space show. And there's nothing behind these companies. And what am I going to do? Do a 60-minute space show program for them to announce they got a founder's round of $1,500,000 with the promise that they're going to go develop a new kind of CubeSat that does A, B, and C? And yet they don't have any manufacturing. They don't have any hardware. They don't have any timelines. And it's absurd. It's like Funnyland. It's like Disneyland for cash flow and wannabe space companies. And I can't imagine that any of these are going to succeed. So that's my story, which backs up what you guys have figured out, and you're one of the few that has figured it out.
I definitely agree with everything you said, and it's comical. And it's one of those things that, you know, everyone should have known that it was going to end and end pretty dramatically hard. And that's something that people who followed that that wave, they're going to lose. And it's really unfortunate, and the ways that the SPACs and the SPAC kind of generation of end of 2020, you know, mid-2020 to, you know, when they really started getting cracked down on the regulatory side towards the, you know, middle of last year. And, you know, that story was being sold to the public that this is the opportunity for every investor, you know, to see the returns of what private, you know, companies normally get. And that was such a sham. It's an unfortunate sham that happened, because you look at it and it's the venture investors really flipping the risk to the public. You know, they have a bad company, and a lot of space companies are bad companies underneath. You look at the public SPAC, you see the numbers, you see the revenue, there's nothing there. Even established companies, they've been around, you know, 10 years. You know, some of them, you know, you look at the revenue numbers and you're like, wait, there's nothing actually there. And the reason those were SPACs was not to get the public, you know, to have exposure to this wonderful growth opportunity. It was the venture investors incentivized to take their bad companies, lock in the valuation by doing a SPAC, push it to the public market, and then exit before it crashes and flip the risk to the public. And that's something that, you know, you're going to look at that in 10 years, and those are the kind of Big Short level, you know, movies and dramas, which is the entire investment community selfishly taking bad companies and giving them to the public. And that's the point of an IPO process. You know, the SPACs are going to go down as a generation of complete, you know, sham and fraudulent representation of companies. And it does highlight, you know, especially what you were saying on the PR side, that the venture community is so focused on signal. They're so focused on vanity, you know, so focused on how much money you're bringing in and what investors were brought in, that it turns into this, bubble building process of who can bring in the right co-investors, the right follow-on investors, hype it up in the right way, do enough to get by into the next fundraising, and repeat that process four or five times, and then figure out how to flip an exit, you know, flip to the public markets and exit. And is that building a good company? No. You know, that's building the smallest amount of effort you can within the company to get by as you build this bubble around it of investors, of hype, of press releases. And I definitely say the trend you saw, it was valuable to hear it from your perspective of what you've been seeing as far as inbound to the show. And that there has to be more and more of that focus on press about fundraising instead of press about product or press about customer agreement, as the companies underneath are worse and worse. So that's something that has been, you know, very frustrating to see. I don't think we're, you know, susceptible to that as a fund. It's definitely something that spooks the growth investors, you know, which is going to be the biggest impact to us, is that it'll be harder to win over follow-on investors at times because the market not only is less active, but they've seen that this is more and more of a difficult market. But that's a challenge we accept and we think the portfolio is prepared for, is these are good companies, you know, market downturn or not. And that we're not expecting to make money off these, off of just doing press releases and hyping up who's coming in on the follow-on round. It's building real companies underneath. And one of those things you mentioned, I wanted to touch base on it. You'd mentioned, you know, companies that have crazy ideas with, you know, founders with no experience. And I was one of those founders. You know, Relativity was one of those companies 7 years ago. So I've seen the potential for these paper companies and paper ideas to become successful multi-billion dollar companies that have products, have revenue, have technical differentiation, that are real companies underneath with real demonstrated tech and differentiation. But it's something that most of those companies, you know, the majority of those companies are not. And it's deciphering through of those companies that are paper companies, which ones are the ones that are going to break through and get off paper. And most investors don't have that potential. Or it becomes laughable. Like you were saying, you look at these companies and they have no plans, no progress, no hardware. That's why at Relativity, and you can see this during my time there, kind of 2015 to 2020, we had a rule, no renderings in press. And that's why we didn't do any press for the first 2 years, right? We did our first PR announcement when we had built the first full-scale printer and built the first full-scale upper stage tank in that printer and demonstrated that that printed tank had better properties, was cheaper to make, and was lighter than traditional manufactured rocket stages. So we had demonstrated the core tech of the company, that it was going to be better economically. It made sense to buy it. It was performing better. And the company's tech was fully working. And we knew that if we said, you know, as these young 20-year-olds, you know, 20-something-year-olds, that we were 3D printing a rocket and developing the world's largest metal 3D printers as these two, you know, USC aerospace engineers, we would be laughed out of the market, laughed out of the press, if we had done that with a rendering in 2015, you know, when you know anything. And we slowly built the company up, you know, built the tech up, proved it incrementally, stage by stage, of building the printers, demonstrating the process, demonstrating the material properties, doing subscale tests, and eventually getting to that full-scale demonstration of the upper stage in the end of 2017, that we had finished that first upper stage tank, tested it, and gone to press. We did our first announcement with Ashley Vance at Bloomberg in 2017. But you can see that heritage and what we really drove, you know, especially during those early years. And no renderings in press was an absolute rule. And if you saw that, you know, if you even kept that as your rule on, you know, who can see on the space show, is if you only have renderings, you're not on there. You filter out 99% of the community, you know, a higher percentage now than it would have done, you know, years ago because of the craziness in the market.
Jordan, I've got a caller on hold, so let me take it. But just to kind of put in perspective, listeners, what we're talking about, and I know current market conditions may be unfair to extrapolate into space, But when I checked it a few minutes ago, the market was off about 560 points. But Virgin, a SPAC, an initial SPAC, is now at $633 a share. And UFO, the exchange-traded fund, and we have Andrew on quite frequently, is now at $21 a share, which is way, way down from where its high was. And they're really vulnerable to what is happening in the market and the tightening of interest rates. And listeners, I've been saying, you know, they're going to tighten up interest rates, and this is going to affect capital flows into private space. And everyone says, no, no, space is so small, it won't matter. Even economists that I've had on the show say that. And I'm, even though economics was part of my graduate studies, I'm not an economist. But boy, it doesn't take a lot of vision to smell some stinking rats out there. But I think the industry is very vulnerable, and we're watching it play out just with a couple of those examples. Let's see who our caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show today. And where are you and who are you? And certainly thank you for all your great patience in waiting for us.
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Ah, an early stage investor in space. Welcome to the show. Do you like what you're hearing?
Not yet. I see that you only have, well, I'm looking at the website and I see just five different companies in the fund right now. Are there more?
We have investments we've done that are not announced at this stage.
Okay. And what is the criteria for adding companies to the portfolio? I mean, do you have metrics that you use that will drive, you know, what companies get added to the fund?
I wouldn't say there's one specific metric. You know, these companies are generally pre-revenue, very small, just the founders. And I wouldn't say there's any specific criteria that, you know, you can put as a quantitative number on them. I'd say if you were, and the only quantitative one is, you know, very early in size, just, you know, pre-seed, seed, series A. And we do some opportunistic later stage investments as we find good opportunities. And, but it's really looking at the companies as far as which ones will, you know, demonstrate good returns as good companies, whether private or public. And, to your question, we are a younger fund. We started in 2020. Then it sounds like you have your own space investments yourself. I'd love to hear more about you and, you know, what your thoughts are on having a smaller versus, you know, larger portfolio as an early fund manager.
Well, I'm a investor in UFO, so I like diversification, and you know, they have a whole set of criteria that ensures that you know, companies that are included in the fund have the potential for you know, revenue growth and there's a lot of different companies in the fund, so you know, diversification is important to me. So I you know, when I see only five companies and it's all, I mean, these are really early stage, so there's no revenue yet, right?
The majority of the companies have revenue in one form or another. And at the time of the investment, you know, I'd say significantly less had revenue numbers. But that's it's a very different investment approach of building an ETF versus, you know, early stage investing. And right, we're investing in companies that are pre-revenue, you know, to, you know, the craziness of the market and, you know, perhaps traditional venture capital investment that is not, you know, digging into the companies nearly as much. Like you can read, you know, books from top general partners in the venture capital community, and I would differentiate ourselves from those. And that's why the word venture can sometimes be misleading. And I think even for us, as far as our title, and because, you know, you can read theses on, you know, power law distributions and venture and trying to, you know, differentiate sufficiently a number of bets that maybe one of them by luck ends up being a good company. And that's how so many funds invest. They're not qualified to actually dig into these companies before they are, you know, solely based on firm, you know, metrics and ratios and growth numbers. You know, if you want a thesis that matches that of, you know, some top Silicon Valley VCs, it's, you know, differentiate sufficiently that you're in, you know, a couple hundred companies, you know, with small checks. It's make sure they're, you know, 300% month or year over year growth, that they're, you know, situated in Silicon Valley so they can build hype and attention from the Silicon Valley investor base. And, you know, your fourth criteria is that they're overpriced, therefore the market's recognizing the hype of them. That can be your thesis, and you can build a fund off of that. And I'd say that's perfectly ripe for crashing during a downturn, because that's not actually looking at companies with leading indicators. It's looking at lagging indicators like short-term revenue of an early-stage company, and not the ability for them to shape the market, have long-term adoption, long-term technical moats. And that's why we have very few companies. You know, we deploy, you know, not based off of an explicit criteria of, you know, certain revenue growth threshold means this will be a good company in 5 years. You know, our investment horizons, you know, 7 to 10, right? You know, that is the expectation of our investor base, is that these are extremely well-performing investments in 7 to 10 years. And that's not something that's based short-term in, you know, today's revenue numbers. And I would say, and Dr. Livingston brought this up as well, that the broad diversification of the UFO ETF, I don't think that's necessarily gotten good performance return. I don't know if that thesis of protection through diversification is one that has been effective.
So you've got a 7 to 10 year horizon, you say, and so how are you choosing? How do you look out that far ahead and choose companies that are going to generate revenue in that time frame? How do you choose the companies? I'm not clear on how that's done.
How do we choose the companies? We run an investment process, and, you know, it starts with just inbound deal flow, you know, ask them outbound as well. And whereas venture capital investors, we're looking at companies, you know, they're pitching to us, we're digging in with them. We run our process where there's four or five, you know, kind of key areas, you know, the team, the founders, you know, their ability to build a company. You know, generally these are people that have never built companies before. And that's why it's early stage investing. You know, I've been one of those people before. You know, I've grown a multi-billion dollar company as a 22-year-old. You know, I started a fund, you know, with Jenna to support, you know, founders doing the same. And we even spun a company out of the fund, you know, which is well on its way to being a unicorn as well. You know, and I run that company day to day as CEO. So how did investors choose me as a 22-year-old as someone to make a bet on that had just been an aerospace engineer for 18 months in industry? It's the same process we run. It's getting to know them, figuring out if they're people to make a bet on, understanding the market timing, the tech, the differentiation, the strategy, and seeing if we can build a cohesive thesis that we have conviction in, that this will become a good company. And is that rigorous quantitative analysis on year-over-year growth? Anyone doing that on an early-stage company is garbage, so that's a waste of time to do. You're going to find hot garbage if you're doing, you know, week-over-week revenue growth of an early-stage space company that's a year in or less. And but for us, we rely on our experience as founders, as operators. We have a one-of-its-kind partnership with the U.S. Space Force and through CRADA, specifically on helping guide and navigate the mutual growth of startups that they're looking at and startups that we're looking at. And you make those bets then that these are companies. But, you know, the sole investment criteria being revenue is one of the most short-sighted things you can ever do as an early-stage investor, especially in a sector where revenue is something that ramps up significantly later than, let's say, a software space, like a software ecosystem. And so I don't think there's any one thing to say on, like, what is our investment criteria, but it's that, you know, we have strong conviction in our thesis and we decide to proceed. And then as a partnership, we unanimously, you know, choose to proceed. There's three of us as partners here between myself, Jenna, and then we have an operating partner. Her name is Mandy Vaughn. But hopefully that answers your question. I don't think I can give like an explicit set of criteria, but if you asked any early stage venture fund what their criteria is, they're not going to give you, you know, a number like a quantitative analysis of these companies. And if they do, I'd say that's a terrible way to be early stage investing.
All right. Well, I guess we have to place a lot of trust in you, in your ability to choose companies. So good show, and thanks for coming on.
John, don't you do that with all investments? You place trust in money managers. You place trust in fund managers. If you have a fund in an IRA like Vanguard or, you know, one of the commercial ones that are out there, you're trusting these people, most of whom you don't know, but you get a paper bio on them, usually with impressive
track
record.
Yeah, I look for a track record.
Success. Yeah.
I look for a track record and how well they do.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
So their track record comes differently than most track records, which I find to be really interesting. Anyway.
Me too.
I appreciate the call, and we'll talk to you later. Thank you again. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. Listeners, there's still time if you would like to call us. The toll-free number is, let me pull it up for you, 866-687-7223. Can you expand on your Space Force relationship? What are you actually in a relationship with the Space Force to help them accomplish or to do for them?
Yeah, it's a collaborative agreement. The formal name is a CRADA, which is a collaborative R&D agreement. It's between us as Embedded Ventures and then SpaceWorks, which is, you know, in kind of summary, that's Space Force's innovation arm that is startup facing. And so we share the same goal, and that's where the relationship started to build. It was something that Jenna originally thought up, you know, about this time, maybe a little bit earlier than this month. It was maybe like February or March of last year, and which was us, you know, building our thesis, you know, seeing how other funds were operating and making decisions. And then, you know, very much us, you know, realizing that the government was always going to be a player in, you know, not only, you know, building our sector up, the space sector, use cases, customers, you know, future revenue, you know, stuff that, you know, we see as signal towards these companies getting revenue in the future is them being aligned with government needs. That's one of those areas, you know, the comment on that we look into as we, you know, establish our theses on these companies is will they attract strong government revenue, you know, in addition to commercial long-term. But it's something that the two groups, you know, Department of Defense and Venture, they never talk. And that was something we realized. That was something that me and Jenna had realized, you know, very early on. You know, she has a strong national security passion because her brother is a V-22 Osprey pilot in the South China Sea, you know, and she wants him to have, you know, the best tech. You know, I come from, you know, the national security background between the work at Relativity, and it's hard to avoid it in aerospace. And I won't go into any specifics. I got your heads up, you know, that the audience here is broadly based, you know, around the world. But it's something that we see a very strong role for venture capital in shaping innovation in national security. You know, Silicon Valley was built originally on national security development in the Cold War. And now there's this aversion to it. It's almost taboo in the United States, you know, at times, depending on the community you're in, you get viewed, you know, as this taboo or this, like, you know, xenophobe if you're passionate about national security. And it's something that, you know, I've lived the American dream, kind of the boilerplate American dream of having an idea, starting a company, getting financing for it, and then afterwards being able to do whatever you want. And I come from a working class background. My dad's a elementary school teacher. My mom worked at UPS for 33 years as a line worker. And, you know, I wasn't born into, you know, the finance world or the venture capital world like so many are. So me being able to do that, you know, I think that's something that this country enables. And if you don't like that approach, this country enables you to talk about that you don't like it. You know, it's something that those freedoms and liberties, you know, I think, you know, we have an obligation as U.S. business owners to support. But you see so much of the venture capital industry dithering into consumer tech, dithering into foreign infrastructure development, dithering into so many areas that are not building the strategic base of the United States and in long-term defensibility of it. I think that's something that's extremely troubling. So we leaned into the partnership with SpaceWorks and Space Force more broadly in order to figure out, and we're the first and only, and still only venture capital fund that does this, then we wanted to see the Space Force, you know, and all of their work with Space Force, where they're trying to make it easier for DoD to work with startups. We wanted to see startups be better positioned to work with the DoD, to kind of push from the other direction and meet halfway, rather than what every venture capital fund does today, you know, other than us, which is wait for the moment that DoD is easy enough to work with that it's the same ease as working with a consumer company or working with a dating app. And it's never going to be that easy. You know, you're waiting for a future that's not going to happen if you want DoD to be as easy to work with as a dating app, you know, or a company that's just advertising to consumers. So we built up that Space Force partnership to just open the door between both groups. It's a communication thing. There's not like a quantitative result out of it, you know, a specific result and outcome. But it's specifically, you know, how do we get their goals, which is building the U.S., you know, space industrial base. That's one of their taglines. And our thesis, which you could rephrase as building the space industrial base, you know, that is a very similar thesis between the two. How do we do that in a symbiotic manner? You know, we're both putting money in. We're both having goals for these companies. And when you don't open the door between the two groups and they're trying to build companies in a way where their contract gives signal to the venture community that this market's going to be real in 5 years, in 7 years. You know, they have the intent of attracting private investors through the capital they deploy. And we have the intent of bringing in government as a customer from the capital that we deploy. So the growth arcs and the story and the timeline, they intertwine. You know, we kind of solve each other's valleys of death of growth if you do it right. But if you don't do it right, they're spending all this money, they're getting appropriations to support the startup community, and if that doesn't work, right, if you don't open the door, you don't have that discussion, you don't figure out how to grow these companies together, you know, mutually and symbiotically for mutual success here, both financially for the investors and for the country strategically, you can get all that whole effort to fizzle. Investors don't see the potential in return, so they slow down the inflows to these startups. And because they don't think space and national security is an area to make money. And then Congress is looking at all these appropriations they did to build these new departments, to spin out the Space Force to be this more nimble wing that can work with the commercial industry easier, you know, to stand up these efforts, to give startups capital. But if that capital doesn't bring in venture investors in the way that they intended it to, and it doesn't provide that signal in a way that's effective, that's a 5 to 10 year cycle that you mess up. Then you have to wait for that to be forgotten on a appropriation side, forgotten that didn't work or didn't achieve the goal that was intended, for them to try again. And that's something that I don't think as a country we have time to cycle through that experiment multiple times of trying to get Department of Defense to work with startups in an innovative manner. You know, it's kind of now or never for innovation and providing those, you know, new tech implementations and products to the U.S. strategic base there. And that's the main goal of the partnership, is bring both sides together and build these companies together. And to even touch base on the call-in question, that's one of the signal areas we look at is this going to be someone who can win a massive contract in 5 years and in 10 years? Because that contract's not here today, but you're trying to build the company that's perfectly positioned to win that in 5 years. And there's indicators both on all sides as far as trying to figure out if that's the right company to invest in for that potential future opportunity.
You have an email from Ben, who is in Seattle, and Ben says, just how easy is it to work the national security side with DoD or the Space Force or any other government entity? Is it easy? Is it costly? Is it enhanced and ensconced in regulatory problems? Do you have a problem navigating it?
That's a great set of questions. Do we have a problem navigating it? It's a challenge. It's a challenge we accept as far as going uphill with. You know, we could dive through companies that never have government as a player. They are unregulated, you know, or light or understood on a regulatory side. The space ecosystem's hard, right? Government as a customer is hard. Department of Defense as a customer is harder. Then where you're positioning on things like making sure the cap table, you know, the investments, you know, the kind of capitalization table, and who are investors in these companies, who has information flow, who has control out of the investor base, and how does all of that fit together? You as an early stage company can take a check and you don't know who's on the other side of that check. You know, who's backing these funds? Who gets information from these funds? You know, who controls these funds? It may not be obvious. It's something that no one ever talks about their limited partners, or what we call LPs. And who's on the other side of these massive mega funds? You generally don't know. And you don't know to ask as a first-time founder. And that is something that is extremely taken advantage of in the national security kind of investment space and some of the, you know, back and forth between, you know, international players here, which is, you know, who is backing all the funds, you know, other than us. We're very selective in who we take, you know, money from and who we deploy from because of this. But you can take one check as a first-time founder without knowing to ask the right questions. And that check can make it because it's, you know, tied to, let's say, a hostile foreign government who's backing it on the other side of that fund. That can make it so you can never, ever win a DoD contract as a company. And you may build your company for 3 or 4 years before you realize that you're never going to have that market accessible, even if you wanted it. And that is something that makes it very difficult to navigate the ecosystem, because we end up responsible not only for helping grow these companies, but we need to diligence them at a level of understanding their co-investors, the investment space, the dynamics there, at a level where many of these companies don't understand. Many of the other funds don't even know these questions, because they're investing in space companies without understanding, you know, things like CFIUS, you know, where it's a Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. They don't understand the constraints there. They've never been an operator. They've never gotten a defense contract themselves. They've never been under scrutiny by CFIUS and Department of State as a startup on understanding if there is foreign ownership and control that they may not even be aware of. So, yes, it's very difficult to navigate that ecosystem. You know, that's a lot of why many companies do not lean, or many funds do not lean into the sector. Or you see companies that should be winning government contracts or not, is that they're tainted and they didn't even know it. And there is hostile capital and hostile funds out there where they're intentionally taking advantage of how the U.S. is so consumer focused that it leaves a hole where no one's funding the space opportunities. No one's funding what you'd call like deep tech, you know, the harder to build companies for infrastructure, for manufacturing, for space tech, for a huge number of areas. So who do those founders turn to? They turn to foreign capital, or it's foreign capital that's intentionally exploiting the U.S.'s over-focus on consumerism to invest in these companies, get foreign control, foreign ownership, foreign data flow, you know, intellectual property flowing into those funds, and then, you know, getting all that information. Then as those companies scale and they're actually positioned to win that one massive contract that they wanted to get, they realize they can't do it. In their years of development was leached into a hostile country, and they're never going to work with the U.S. government because, you know, that capital is never going to flow into them because of the ownership structure. So it's years, you know, years of effort of some of these startups goes to complete waste, if not directly leached into the hands of, you know, people who would rather see the U.S. fall sometime this century. It's a really frustrating environment to navigate.
Well, to many of us, we are falling pretty rapidly. So that may be not a subject for this space show, but this is a huge problem that you're addressing. And having been a Californian for close to 40 years and in the Bay Area, it's hard to imagine why venture capital and why Silicon Valley and why some of the trends that are in existence today came about rather than what it was about when I graduated college in the late 60s and went to graduate school, because it was a very different world for venture capital back then. Not so much in the revenue and in what they made, but in their attitudes and their goals and their role in the country and in the communities. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I don't know what caused it, and it's probably not for this show, especially since we're pretty far over the 60 minutes that I promised you about. But I was close to it, and a lot of my early years were in the oil and gas industry. And, you know, that has certainly changed, too, out of politics rather than more technological truth-telling. But it is what it is,
well,
as the old saying goes.
I know we're a little over time, but how about I wrap up with some comments on that.
Okay.
Because I think it's worthwhile for the audience, and it's one of the takeaways that I like people to have is just trying to have a greater awareness of, you know, some of those trends as far as, you know, Silicon Valley and all of the innovation and freedoms and liberties in Silicon Valley having an aversion to what protects having those freedoms and liberties. And it is a really interesting kind of migration and transformation over a number of decades. And it's been a slow process, but it's something where you see highlighted a little bit less now than it used to be, things like foreign infiltration in social media, kind of foreign influence in shaping the U.S. narrative, whether it's politically, economically, you know, creating divides. You know, there's been significant commentary on the social media side, and I think it's something, you know, put yourself in the mind of someone. Try to put yourself in the mind of someone who doesn't think on a 2-year time scale politically, a 4-year time scale politically, or, you know, a business decision that's just for short term shareholder return. If you're trying to think on a, you know, 100-year time scale as a country, which we don't do in the U.S.,
we're
not trained
to
do it. 100-year time scale, put yourself in, you know, the mind of someone who wants to see the U.S. slowly decay because you're a country that wants to, you know, raise their global prowess. Then, yeah, you do what you can to shape narrative on social media, but there's so many other ways that's done, you know, as far as slowly sliding into shaping investment, shaping policy, shaping a drive towards consumerism, shaping an aversion to national security development. Or even the things I was mentioning on interesting ways capital gets deployed as a weapon to get control of national security companies, to flow information from national security startups, to make it so these companies can't work with the U.S. government after there's been years and perhaps tens of millions of dollars poured into them to realize of, oh, there's a foreign limited partner with a very hostile approach that actually controls this company. And that's something where, is that an accident that's happening? No, that is a very intentional strategy to slow down the U.S. national security development by making it something that's taboo, shaping that narrative, slowing the companies down by having them have these foreign ownership structures that are deployed very late into the process or found out about very late into the process. And having, you know, venture investors that are very hawkish at finding these companies that don't know better, that could be amazing national security assets, and finding them at a time where they can become that first check. And then that company is flowing information, intellectual property, updates, and then eventually blocked out from their own national security development because they took that first check at a time that the founder didn't know any better. And there's no watchdog to help them along that process. No one's there training them to say, hey, before you take your first check, you know, figure all these things out, because there's not the resources, there's not the information flow, and it's not something that you can talk about publicly at times without being, you know, attacked for racism, for being unopen to international thought. It's a very kind of frustrating ecosystem, but again, it's the takeaway to, you know, for the listeners, which is there does need to be. And I hope there is a growing element of this. I'm not terribly optimistic. It's growing in awareness. If anything, it's shrinking in ability for it to be talked about publicly. Is that there is very intentional strategy well beyond just social media influence that is shaping the narrative of this country, where the dollars are going, where the startups are going, you know, where the bigger companies are going and how they prioritize. That is well beyond anything we're trained to comprehend on timescale strategically at either a political or economic level.
Well,
I just hope more than more people have an awareness and see what happens as that awareness grows.
Well, I also think it's contributed to by Congress and government policy, and I think it's contributed to by our education system. I think we're really dangerous about it, and these forces are far more successful than the group that has awareness and would like to do something to counter it. And you know, I allude to it on the space show all the time, as it's a nonprofit the space show, so I can't really do politics except space politics. So, you know, I have to tread lightly about it. But if I weren't a nonprofit, I would not be treading lightly about it, because I value what made all of us great and gave us the freedoms and liberties to do what we do, including starting a damn radio show about commercial space 20 plus years ago. I had the freedom to do that. And I don't know, you know, what's going to be in another 10 years. And it worries me. And, you know, most older people like to exit knowing they left the world better than the world that they inherited. And I talk to a lot of geezers like myself. I'm sorry to put myself in that category. But there's a lot of concern about this with older people and retired people, that they're not going to be leaving the world better than what they inherited. And they have a lot of regrets on the roles that they've played. But I think you're addressing it. You're young. And I hope that you find associates and others willing to address it, and you come up with winning strategies and somehow convey them to people in government and people who have positions of so-called power, because that's how we got to be a great country in space. And,
right.
You know, I'd hate to see it get trashed, but that's another show. But this has really been fun and informative and surprising in many ways talking to you. So I'm very glad for this opportunity, and I hope we can touch base with you later on and stay in touch with you on some of the economic and investment and goal-setting things for the space community, especially in these troubling times that we seem to be entering into.
You know, I appreciate that, and it's definitely something that I really like how you tied that together with the space show and the history there, as far as, you know, us being able to talk about this publicly and concerns and, you know, our own government direction of supporting some of these efforts and the challenges we've had is something that most other countries you can't do, you know, or many countries around the world you can't do. So it's something that definitely echoes everything I was saying. And I think it's, I have realized, and it's why I speak up on it more and more, that I am rare of my generation and age to have a combination of the awareness of some of these issues, the platform, you know, which I'm grateful for, to be able to speak in a way that people, you know, hear me, and, you know, I get invited for opportunities like this to speak on it in a way where there's a platform there. But it's something that it is rare for, you know, I'm 29, you know, as far as my generation to care, to be knowledgeable about it, and to have a platform. That's why I speak up on it. That's why I wanted that to be, if of anything, the one takeaway, and is that I'm very lucky that I'm able to say that in a broad-based manner.
And, well, and that,
but yeah, same concerns and topic for next time.
And that you have the courage to speak up about it. And I think that's a really, really big important part of it, because sometimes the ramifications for speaking up are pretty nasty. So just something to keep in mind. I look forward to the next one, and I hope on the next one Jenna is able to join you. I look forward to talking to her as well.
Yes.
And I will let you know when the program is archived and playing, and look forward to talking to you down the road and tapping into your experience and your ability to see sort of what's in the future and your wisdom about space investments. And I think this is a really good source of information for space show listeners here in the United States as well as around the world. So we will talk again for sure. And great connecting with you, and thank you very much for being a guest on the space show today.
Same here. Thank you very much. Look forward to part two, and you know, me, you, Jenna, talking on the same subjects a little deeper. And thank you for your time, and for especially everyone who wrote in or called in as well. I appreciate the question.
By the way, where are you physically located? Are you in California, or where are you?
I am in California. I live just outside of L.A. in Agora Hills.
Okay, I know Agora Hills. Well, I decided to pull the plug after about 40 years and move to Nevada. So I'm still unpacking boxes, but just the taxes and the cost of living and the abuses, the economic abuses and and the way people get treated, I just couldn't take it anymore. It's too hard to do, especially if you're coming up on fixed income. And so I pulled the plug. My two kids are still in California, so I'm still definitely connected to it. But, boy, they need to make some changes. I don't see it coming, but they sure could benefit by some fresh blood. But maybe it'll happen. Maybe you'll run for office someday. Thank you again. Listeners, that's it for today. We're coming up on the weekend, so make sure you enjoy it. Keep it safe. And as always, keep looking up. And goodbye from Jordan, David, and the Space Show, and his dog that we did not get to meet, but we did get to hear. Once again, a great weekend to everybody, and keep it safe. Until Sunday, signing off here at the Space Show.